Mmm, the first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Kunstler Cast. Thanks for listening. My guest this time is Tom Luongo, the voice behind the Gold, Goats, and Guns podcast and blog, often featured on Zero Hedge. Tom describes himself as a former research chemist, an amateur dairy goat farmer, an anarcho-libertarian, and obstreperous Austrian economist. He built the house he lives in, and he's a lot of fun. So without further ado, here's my chat with him. Tom Luongo, a pleasure to touch base with you again. We've been following the action in the stock market this week. Looks like some kind of a weird Ludwig von Mises crack-up boom. It's just the weirdest thing to see these markets and indexes just fly up into the stratosphere when it looks like we're on the verge of World War III. What is going on?
Well, we're not on the verge of World War III, James. Thank you very much for having me on. I really do appreciate the invite. You know, I know you and I have talked a couple of times on my podcast, so I'm happy to do this show. The situation in the markets is very weird, right? I don't see them actually levitating at this point. And I don't think we're on the verge of World War III. I think World War III started 3 weeks ago. The kinetic portion of it, the sanctions and financial war started 8 years ago when the Russians reunified with Crimea. But what's happening in the U.S. markets in particular is this is something I've been warning about for a long time now. I'm not the only one. I stand on the shoulder of many, many giants who have influenced me over the years, and one of whom is Martin Armstrong. And he was saying for years that there was going to be a capital flight wave into the United States at some point once things got really weird. You know, once the violence started, once the tanks started crossing borders, once the financial system started to collapse, you have to remember that there's a world out there that's biblically short dollars because there's so much dollar-denominated debt out there. Uh-huh. And you're right to invoke Mises and the crack-up boom here, because I think this is one of those times where we've reached the limit of credit and we've reached the limit of how many fake or paper dollars you can create, or what Zoltan Posar called the other day. I just don't call him Poser because that's wrong. Inside money, money that only exists within the financial system, because the guy is anything but a poser, right? Zoltan Posar is quite the dude. So I look at this and I'm not surprised at all. I also don't think that the Dow Jones is, you know, in any kind of bull market here. It's clearly, and you know, looking at like a weekly chart, if you do a technical analysis, you look at a weekly chart, it's clearly in a downtrend since, you know, about 3 or 4 months ago, and it's down 15-18% off of its highs around 37 grand. It's trading in the 33s. The thing is that we all get so myopic because we're all so American, and unfortunately Americans, because we still think we're the center of the world, you know, only look at American markets. And I got news for you. Like, China's off 40%. Most of Europe is off 40%. The Euro Stoxx 50 is down 40%. The CAC 40, in France, the German DAX, like, these are all off 30, 35, 40%. And they're far worse off than the United States equity markets are. But also, when you're dealing with this kind of situation, right, where, okay, we have a war on our hands and governments are going crazy, like sanctioning people and freezing oil markets and, you know, freezing capital and all this stuff. What do you think people are going to do? People go to cash and people go to tangible assets. So You're going to hold on to your bonds? You're going to hold on to your government debt? Or are you going to get the tangible assets? And one of the things I found really interesting this week, right, that you bring this up, I've been watching, this is one of the things I've been watching all week, is that everything else seems to be getting sold other than cash, right? There's been no significant moves in any of the big currency pairs, like the dollar versus the euro, or the dollar versus the yuan, or even versus the yen, or the British pound, and whatnot. And that's telling me that everybody, well, they're all kind of selling equities and bond yields are rising. So people are selling bonds and there's other stuff going on, and gold and silver really can't move anywhere. They, you know, up $40 one day, down $30 the next day. Everybody's, you know, getting the cash. Everybody's selling all of these assets across the board and they're moving into cash because they're not sure what to do with it. Eventually that cash is going to start moving. And that's when things get really interesting. So,
but the stock indexes are inflating, or there's capital going into them. Where's that capital coming from?
Well, it's most of it's coming out of Europe. Let's not kid ourselves. Europe is in serious trouble. Like I said, when you're looking at the CAC 40 down 40%, you're looking at the FTSE 100 in the UK down somewhere between 30 and 40%. And the same thing with the German DAX. Also, you know, German 10-year bonds are have moved 60 basis points in the last 2 months. Like, where do you think that money's going? It moves into U.S. assets. There are people who follow this stuff far more closely than I do because, you know, they have a Bloomberg terminal and I don't. So every once in a while, I have to get a note from somebody, you know, who come across my Twitter feed or in a comment in a blog post or, you know, on Zero Hedge or something like that. It says, well, you know, last week I saw working on an article on Zero Hedge, like that last week we saw $9 billion flow out of European stocks and into U.S. stocks. Like, there you go. There's $9 billion. And, you know, when the U.S. markets get cheap, like, and they're going to get cheap. They're going to go down into the 29. I think the Dow is going to hit the 29 area, right? Mm-hmm. 29 grand area. This is where medium term support is.
Well, Jim Rickards is calling for an 80% crash in the.
A lot of people are.
But you don't see it that way.
No, not at all. I don't, because I see an 80% crash in somebody's markets, just not ours. Mm-hmm. Eventually, I see an 80% crash in our markets, but not before somebody else's markets crash 80%. Like it's the order of operations that matter. I've been saying this is something that I tried to make the point of.
Interesting concept.
Yes. Order of operations is very important.
Uh-huh.
Right. When we think about this stuff, like the general thesis of the dollar going to, you know, oblivion is just not a hard thesis to put together if you're any kind of Austrian or any kind of just, you know, you use any kind of logic and you dispense with Keynesianism.
Even
hardcore Keynesians will tell you that, you know, the way we're acting, it's going to send the dollar to oblivion. I mean,
let's be clear that when we say we're Austrians, we mean economic, financial Austrians, yes. not Austrian nationals.
Not Austrian nationalists. No, we're talking about the Austrian School of Economics centered around the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. People like Ludwig von Mises, you mentioned earlier, and Murray Rothbard, and to a lesser extent, Friedrich Hayek, and others, and Joe Salerno, and Hans Hermann Hoppe, and Gary North, and Lou Rockwell, and all those guys. So when we're, you know, if you're any kind of Austrian, or even if you're a doctrinaire Keynesian, because, like, you know, we don't even practice Keynesianism. We practice a kind of weird bastardization of post-Keynesian Samuelsonian economics. And only a geek like me would know this. Like, Paul Samuelson wrote the most popular and most widely used economics textbook in the United States back in the early 60s, which was basically his version of Keynesian economics. And that's what everybody learned. That's what the two generations of bankers and bond traders and everything else that have been running this country into the ground learned. And even Samuelsonian economics is not Keynesian. And I can't tell you the differences at this point. I just remember reading about this stuff, you know, when I was much younger and had more hair. It's in the dark corners of my gray matter, and it just sits there. And it's a talking point I bring up every once in a while to remind people that maybe if you really want to know what's going on here, go and read Samuelson's textbooks, and then go read Keynes's general theory, and then, you know, you make the call as whether these two things are the same or not. Right? I tend to not want to spend too much time in the minds of my enemies. So,
hey, let's climb out of this rabbit hole for a second.
Sorry.
That's all right. I have generally thought that the value of gold tended to hinge upon two things, whether the currency was inflating and whether political stability was withering away and cracking up. And we seem to have both of those conditions about as strongly as you can get them right now. And yet every day gold is getting hammered. What's going on?
No, a lot of things are going on. So we're at the moment of truth as to whether or not they can continue the confidence game in the paper gold market. I brought up Zoltan Pozsar's article the other day, which I riffed off of in a piece that I think, which is what actually generated your invite to this podcast. Right?
Yeah, the Zero Hedge story.
Right. Yeah, the article about inside versus outside money and all of that. And I do recommend everybody, if not, you don't even have to read my article. I don't really care. Just read Pozsar's article, which I linked to, the new Bretton Woods, where he talks about we're gonna leave this monetary system built on inside money, which is money that only exists within the financial system. It can't exist in the real world because it doesn't exist in the real world. It's all ephemeral paper money or digital paper money or digital representations of paper bits that don't actually exist anywhere and only in the minds of the sick and the twisted.
Hey, and by the way, are there simply too many things out there that pretend to represent real capital?
Yes, that's part of the problem. That's why they can manipulate the price of gold the way they have. And the, you know, there's 300 ounces of 200 to 300 ounces worth of paper gold out there, which is kind of inside gold as opposed to outside gold, right? Out there for every ounce of gold that the COMEX and the LBMA can lay their dirty little paws on. And of course, one day someone is going to finally just say, you know what, I want all the gold on the exchange. Now, from what I understand, that's already happened multiple times, and they've just been, you know, force majeure has been declared on the COMEX, or what I like to call the CRIMEX. And here, no, never mind. You don't get gold. You get dollars. Now go away. Now shut up. And
so they don't deliver the actual metal.
No, because it's actually written into every COMEX contract that, you know, they don't have to deliver the gold.
Yeah.
The gold futures contract is a liquidity sink for excess dollars. Mm-hmm. That's what it's for. And it's the same thing what they're doing to Bitcoin through, you know, futures contracts on the CME with Bitcoin. So they're doing the same thing with it.
Are you saying that the futures markets have taken over Bitcoin, basically?
Oh, in many ways, yeah, they absolutely have. They're not trading at all. Bitcoin's not trading at all like it used to. Mm-hmm. It's not trading like a free market anymore. It's trading like gold. it was the week that they...
A gold with no value.
Yeah. And, well, depending on your definition of what no value constitutes. I happen to think Bitcoin has plenty of value.
Okay.
And I don't want to go down that rabbit hole where I explain antecedent value and Mises' regression theorem as to why all this is.
No, but I do want you to go down another rabbit hole.
Sure.
Because the idea of inside and outside money was at the heart of Zoltán Pozsar's paper. I'd like you to try to get our readers hip to that, because sure. It's a central idea.
It really is, actually. And when he put it that way, I was like, wow, how come I never thought of that before? That was one of those, I mean, honestly, as a writer, sometimes, you know how this is, right? As a writer, you're like, you see something that somebody else wrote, and you're like, wow, I'm really jealous.
You bet.
Oh, yeah. It happens all the time. And you're like, no, well done, sir. Bravo. Like, I really wish I'm going to steal that, by the way. I'll give you credit, but I'm still going to steal it. But bravo. So inside and outside money, it's actually really quite a simple concept. As I said earlier, inside money is basically money that can only exist within the financial system, right? And the financial system today exists mostly as a digital series of ledger entries in databases held by banks around the world. Whereas outside money is money that exists, that's exists regardless of whether there's a financial system or not. Gold exists. It just sits there. It's just there. Yeah. And it's outside the financial system. So is oil. So is land. Now, not all of these things are good outside money. Right. I'm not going to talk about their quality as outside money. Right? Mm-hmm. Because they're clearly, if you study Mises' regression theorem, they're clearly some are better than others.
Gold, yeah, like paintings by Jean-Michel Basquiat.
Right. Or gold is better than oil, which is better than land, which is better than, you know, peanuts, which is better than salt, or, you know, whatever. And so, you know, they all have a different amount of what I like to call monetary character. They have mm-hmm. a commodity character and they have a monetary character. And you can actually, you know, take that. You can actually take that and kind of quantify it and go, gold has a monetary character of near one. And, you know, salt today has a monetary character near zero. Because there's no, I'm dead serious when I say this. And Saifedean Ammous, another great Austrian, young Austrian, like new generation Austrian economist, is the one who came up with the concept of stock to flow ratio. This is very important. This is actually really quite important, because we'll go back to the inside money thing as well. Because stock to flow is very, very important. Because stock to flow basically says how much stock is out there that doesn't move versus how much of it that does move. And a commodity can aspire to become a money when it's valued as a store of value more than it's valued for any industrial use.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's the heart of Mises' regression theorem. Well, we can quantify that with stock to flow ratio. Right? We can quantify that with using, well, most 99% of the gold that's out there doesn't move. Most of it doesn't flow at all. It's all just held on the balance sheets of central banks and in people's, you know, jewelry drawers and you know, taped to the inside of their toilet lids or wherever they keep their gold coins, right? Or in a vault or something. It's vaulted somewhere, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, gold has a very, very high stock to flow ratio. Very little of the gold actually moves. Silver, on the other hand, has a stock to flow ratio of nearly zero. There isn't much silver out there being stockpiled. There is in the minds of, you know, speculative investors like myself and others who hold silver, and, you know, the mining companies that hold some in treasury, and then the producers who use it. But that's it. It's like copper. Silver has very similar today, a stock to flow ratio very similar to copper or nickel or any other industrial metal. Oil, very little oil just sits around. It has almost a zero stock to flow ratio. Why? Because we're constantly burning it.
Yeah.
Like, we're burning it and turning it into organic precursors and plastics and all this other stuff. And pharmaceuticals and fertilizer and, you know, cars and all sorts of things, iPhones. So, and then there's, you know, salt, which we don't stockpile salt in order to use it as a store of value. We used to, because it used to be really important.
Yeah.
But we don't. You can use that idea and you can apply it to inside money as much as outside money. So the dollar for inside money, which is, you know, the kind of the king of inside money, has a relatively high stock to flow ratio because 61% of all central bank reserves in the world are dollars, right? They're treasury bonds.
And payments are being made in dollars.
And then this flow is in dollars as well, which is the weird part about this. So we have to constantly, in order to continually grow the financial pile and to grow global GDP, we have to grow the supply of dollars in order to keep dollars both in reserve in everybody's central banks and enough of them out there to flow around the world to liquefy global trade. When you really stop to think about what we've done with the dollar, and is there are three aspects of money. There's the store of value, which is the part we just described. There's the medium of exchange, which everybody understands as well. You know, I offer you dollars, you offer me apples, we agree on a price and we do it. Medium of exchange. The thing we hold to mitigate our time risk for holding a commodity, right? So it's another way of saying that or medium of exchange is a commodity that has zero time discount associated with it. And then the last one is a unit of account. Right. And so how you value things. Right. And so how we do our accounting. Right. So we value everything relative to dollars, and where the dollar is in the denominator of all, you know, exchange rates, whether it be yuan versus dollars or 27-inch monitors, computer monitors on Amazon. Right. The same thing. Like one monitor for every $279 or $300. It's the same thing. There's always a denominator in there somewhere. So you can shift that around. You can make that a different unit of account. And one of the things that I think we went wrong with the dollar reserve system is to say that the dollar needs to be all three of those things at the same time, consecutively and concurrently.
Hmm.
And I've always said this, that this is a real problem because it actually sets up all sorts of paradox. It leads to what's known as Triffin's paradox, which is that the issuing country of the world's reserve currency has to run a constant trade deficit in order to liquefy the world with enough dollars to keep global trade from collapsing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we are. And that eventually then keeps the currency of account weaker or stronger than it should be because we're exporting the inflation that we should be experiencing because the dollars are all going overseas. It also allows us to then distort terribly our economy and give us the false sense that we don't have to produce anything. All we have to do is produce money, and then we get goods. We don't actually have to produce the goods ourselves, which is exactly what's happened.
And yet it seems that global trade is doing exactly that. It's collapsing, and in so many ways, too, mm-hmm. not just
what do you think is going to happen to the dollar? So eventually, the dollar should collapse.
And now, how rapidly do you see that happening?
I don't see it happening rapidly.
Okay.
Okay, that's where I differ from a lot of other people in this space.
Well, explain.
Sure, I'm happy to because it's fun.
and then we got to get back to what the difference.
I love this stuff, unfortunately.
And Tom,
weird.
Then we got to get back to what's inside money and outside money.
So no, we have kind of gotten. So inside money is that. So inside money is that it's just that money that only exists in the financial space, and because of that, eventually inside money isn't real. It's only produced by, well, in this case, it's produced by issuing debt, by issuing IOUs for labor.
And by the way, those are IOUs that are not going to be paid.
Exactly. So at some point, there's a limit to how much inside money you can create to claim tangible goods in the real world. Because that's what money is actually honestly for, right?
Yeah.
We get money in order to go and get the things we actually want. We don't want money unless we're, you know, a miser with some kind of, you know, psychological condition that needs there where you should be spending that money on therapy. right? Just saying. So, but that's what we want. We want them to buy iPhones and coffee and, you know, and hookers and hookers and blow and whatever else we're going to do. What else we're going to do with it? Buy a house, new air conditioner, braces for the kids. I don't know, whatever. So and whatever your heart desires, that's what money's for. So inside money is this weird thing where the people who get to print it and get to produce it are the ones that actually get to claim the most benefit from claiming and buying the stuff in the real world at the best rates.
Yeah.
Because they buy it first and then the Cantillon effect takes over where, you know, the prices don't adjust to the new supply of money because the money has to flow through the economy in order for everybody's prices to adjust. They get to spend tomorrow's money at yesterday's prices for today's goods. Okay. Uh-huh. And that's, and that, right? So they spend tomorrow's money pulling labor from the future because they created a debt. So they paid, they bought, they used tomorrow's money built against our, the debt against, by issuing debt against our future labor to buy today's goods at yesterday's prices. That's the VIG. That's why these people are so powerful. And, but there's a limit to what happens when you do that. Because now what they've done is they've sucked up all of the outside tangible assets, all the outside money. Mm-hmm. And they've suppressed the price of, or the competing outside money, gold, oil, anything that would, that actually could, that could really substitute as the denominator for what the dollar actually represents.
Well, getting back to that, what right. made you say that gold is close to the end of the paper management of gold?
They just cut the producer, one of the major producers of gold and holders of gold and producers of oil, which is what money actually winds up being in the end, which is just tokenized energy, right?
Yeah.
We tokenize some, or labor, or whatever you want to call it. Really, it's labor. But telling energy itself is just a
Well, it's work.
Right. And work is, but it's human work, because mm-hmm. we're the only ones that value anything. At the end of the day, I'm a firm believer, as all Austrians are, in the subjective theory of value. So therefore, things only have value because human beings value them, right? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there's no concept of value. So we wouldn't value them if we didn't think we could apply our mix our labor and our time with that thing in order to create something that's going to alleviate a need and lower our time preference and make our life a little bit more predictable. Uh-huh. Because the universe is hostile and wants to kill us, right? Because we are born into a state of abject poverty and then have to lift ourselves out of it over the course of our life. Right?
So gold's in trouble because a major producer, namely Russia, has all of a sudden been, it's had its career canceled, shall we say.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I know that I kind of get caught in some of the rabbit holes here, but it's important to explain all the other stuff so I can explain what's really going to happen. So Russia is a major producer of oil and a major producer of gold as well. The Russians have the hammer here. They can collapse, along with the Chinese and the Indians working in concert, and the Saudis working in concert, to reprice oil in gold, mm-hmm. in ounces of gold, as opposed to in dollars, which is effectively what's going to start happening. Now, we've kind of heard that the Saudis are going to take yuan, but remember, the yuan in China can be offset with a oil for yuan can be offset with an oil futures contract in Shanghai, which then can be converted, then offset once again into physical gold. So really, the Saudi oil for gold trade already exists through the Shanghai Futures Exchange, mm-hmm. FYI. Okay, because the Shanghai Futures Exchange does not transact paper gold at all. It is a purely physically settled market, FYI. Uh-huh. Huge difference in the LBMA and the COMEX. So the Russians can turn around tomorrow if they really wanted to, and they will at some point, turn around and go, look, we're going to sell our oil at a massive discount to dollars, that in the current price, but we only take it in gold. That's tough. Go find it. Mm-hmm. There is no physical gold. Go find it. Or disgorge it from your central bank reserves. That's nice. If you want to heat your homes with our oil, or you know, whatever you're going to do, we want it in gold. We don't want dollars. We don't want euros. We don't want Indian rupees. We don't want Chinese yuan. Well, we might take Chinese yuan, but we'll certainly not take euros. You feckless Europeans that have stabbed us in the back 1,000 times, you can go scratch. I'm trying to be clean. I don't know if I'm allowed to curse on this podcast or not. So
yeah, pretty much.
I can? Okay, cool. So you can go fuck yourself. So we want gold, you know? It was un sukumsin. We want gold. You European sukumsins. We want gold. I know a very little bit of Russian, and I know how to say son of a bitch in Russian. So thanks to Patton, by the way. So so that's what they do. And if they were to do that, and this is an idea that Luke Roman put out a couple of weeks ago, and I riffed off of it and said, look, all you have to do is say oil and gold are trading at around 17 to 1, 17 barrels to the ounce. Well, raise it. The Russians offer it at 50 barrels to the ounce. That's a $40 gold. That's a $40 oil price, or $35 oil price, right? All of a sudden, there's a massive arbitrage out there for people to go, hey, I can go get physical gold and then go get 3 times the amount of oil I could get if I spent dollars. Mm-hmm. The COMEX and the LBMA are drained of whatever physical gold they have immediately, and both exchanges collapse. Now, another point that Luke made, which was very astute, which is that most of the valuations of the equity markets, which you bring going back to what you asked me about originally, and housing prices and everything else is built on this artificial monetary base of paper gold, that we've levered up this massive thing called the global financial system based on a 300-to-1 leverage of the price of gold to the actual gold that flows around the world. So if you collapse that by a factor of 4 or 5 at the base level, you collapse credit by 500 times. Or 50 times or 70
times. And when that happens, money disappears.
Money disappears. Dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria, the whole, all of it. Like it's, you know, right out of Ghostbusters, dude. It's all bad.
And when the money disappears, what places does it disappear from first?
It's going to disappear from the things that are most vulnerable to changes in interest rates.
So it's housing.
Going to be long, it's going to be long-term debt, right? It's going to be people with extremely long carry trades where they're borrowed short and lent really long to get the VIX. So they borrow at 0.2%. You know, they borrow a 1-year bond at 0.2% to buy a 30-year bond at 1%, and then they get the 0.8% spread, right? Well, when the short-term bond rises in price and the long-term bond doesn't, or rises in yield and the short-term and the long-term bond doesn't move, and that interest rate spread collapses, that carry trade needs to be unwound.
Does that actually blow up the whole bond market?
It does. We've seen carry trade, currency carry trades blow up bond markets many times. The Greek crisis of 2015, the Italian crisis of 2011, the, you know, every time we see something like that, you know.
Our newest sponsor is Sage Restoration, a fine company specializing in high-quality traditional paints and materials for building preservation. They'd like to reach all you listeners out there living in the long emergency who are ready to start building a world made by hand. And by the way, they sent me some complimentary refined linseed oil, one of their products. I happen to be a painter myself, an art painter, and I cooked up a batch of my usual painting medium with their product, and boy, was I pleased with that. And now a few words from our sponsor. Peeling paint and rotten wood are modern problems brought on by modern plastic materials. But our building history tells us that it doesn't have to be that way. Craftsmen from the past use natural oil paints and resins to protect wood from the inside out rather than the plastic coatings of today that trap moisture and leave us with a rotten, peeling mess. As specialists in traditional wood preservation, Sage Restoration offers a whole new generation of linseed oil finishes for preserving wood and metal that lasts for decades, that do not peel, and that are easy to maintain. At Sage Restoration, it is our mission to restore our connection to traditional materials that have been proven over time, and work to return the built environment to one that is worth caring about. For more information, visit their website at sagerestoration.com. That's one word, sagerestoration.com. Sage Restoration also sponsors the Eyesore of the Month feature on the Kunstler.com website. We thought that would be a refreshing counterpoint to the typical eyesore buildings we present each month. One of the questions coming out of that is, when that money disappears, is it a matter of people just have less money or people have a lot of money that's worthless?
It depends on what's happening. If it's deflation, the money is actually being destroyed.
Yeah.
Okay. And so those who are holding the who are holding real money, not levered money, unencumbered money, whether it's inside or outside, are going to see a rise in their purchasing power.
Yeah.
Because the money is being destroyed. And the people who existed previously having all these billions and trillions in wealth, well, they're going to have a lot less. And they have lay claim to billions and billions and billions of dollars because it's all based on leverage. What leverage giveth on the way up in terms of power and market share, it takes away twice as fast on the way back down because math.
And those are margin calls.
That's margin calls. And when you start getting to the point where when you're levered 30 to 1, a 5% move or 30 to 1, a 3% move against you wipes you out. When you're levered 8 to 1, a 15% move wipes you out. Right. We are levered. Well, the gold market is levered 300 to 1.
So at that point, you'd think that a lot of people on Wall Street would be jumping out of windows if you could open the windows in modern buildings and if people were actually going to work in offices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, something like that. Yeah, I would think we'll see some of that, but it's not really I don't even know that it's the funny part about this at this point is that everybody knows that this is what's going on. And it's like it's that moment in time where everything systems like this that are built on a ridiculous amount of force and a ridiculous amount of leverage and a ridiculous amount of willful obtuseness, for lack of a better term, are metastable. And they're very fragile. And it takes a very when you have a society as with this much complexity, as my partner was and I talk about all the time, when you have too much complexity, then it's natural that a complex system with a complex supply chain, a complex order of operations and interconnected operations, it takes one of them at, you know, in the middle of the production process to screw the whole thing up and then grind it to a halt. So I saw something yesterday, and they've been saying versions of this for a while now. We all know, you know, supply chains are breaking down. Well, what does that actually mean? Well, it means that like you can't get the screws you need to, you know, replace to build like, you know, some webcam or some thing or, you know, some basic thing that we take for granted, right? It means the rubber gaskets that we would never want to build that we want to do over here, you know, we don't build over here in China that we built over here in the United States and they built in China and ship over here and still ship them over here at, you know, a thousand to the penny, right? Can't be had for love nor money because the plant over in Shenzhen shut down, for example, because the Chinese the other day, this is not a real example. It's just that, you know, China shut down Shenzhen the other day for 50 COVID cases, which, by the way, was their way of supporting the Russian invasion in Ukraine, you know, asymmetric warfare and all that. Mm-hmm. What about those rubber gaskets or those rubber O-rings or whatever that we, you know, need to, you know, build of any number of things or replace any number of things? What about the, you know, the silicon caulk that we need to, you know, re-caulk the flange on the oil refinery distillation column that we just took down for maintenance? And
yeah, sorry, you're going to have to use Doublemint gum instead.
Right. You're going to have to use some weird, yeah, right. You can't, like, once that stuff is gone, and a lot of that stuff is very, having worked in these industries, like, a lot of that stuff is very, very specific. It's not like you can run down the Home Depot and pick up the caulk needed to, you know, to caulk a flange on an oil fractional distillation column at a refinery. You can't. It's a very specific grade of silicone caulk made for almost specifically for that purpose. And so when you have that amount of complexity, it takes very little to destroy it. Once the system starts to just be destroyed from that perspective, well, then all of a sudden it's no different than financial markets. Like one guy breaks the collateral chain of all these interconnected derivatives where I've got a currency carry thing going on, which I've laid off a risk, you know, against your interest rate swap, which is over here against your mortgage backed security, which is, and then, you know, there's like 17 layers of this stuff all tied back in some way to some guy's position on the gold position on the COMEX. And one guy can't pay that, make the mortgage payment on the mortgage backed security and the whole collateral chain breaks. Now, all of a sudden we're in a world of hurt. Now, you know, we're all in a world of shit, to quote Private Joker. Like, it's bad. And we saw this in 2008 with Lehman Brothers. We've got potentials out there are far worse than that, for something far worse than that. And the Russians are sitting there with the sanctions hammer. I've been saying this for years. Like, between their position, between, you know, look at their global position in terms of what they produce in the base commodity markets. You know, you've got tungsten, nickel, titanium, chrome, rare earths, lithium, oil, wheat, fertilizers, urea, blah, 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 blah. We can go on and on and on.
Yeah.
Like nickel was, and I've been homing in on this one for years, going, nickel, we never think about nickel. Why? Because it's well supplied, and yeah, the prices of nickel is volatile, but you need it in every grade of stainless steel that's out there. Mm-hmm. You realize that, you know, stainless steel is anywhere from anywhere from 13% to 20% nickel, depending on the grade of stainless steel, and 3% to 5% chromium. I used to do some metallurgy in the before time when I was a chemist. So, this is very important. Like, we don't have medical grade stainless to make scalpels. We don't have medical grade. We can't, we can't open a new restaurant because no one can, you know, build a new food line, right?
Well, let's hope our surgeon has a Swiss Army knife.
Yeah, exactly. Seriously, like, this is where we are. And so I was not surprised at all to see the LME, the London Metals Exchange, blow up over the nickel market. Because of all the industrial metals, other than silver, it's the most volatile. Mm-hmm. And that means, of course, that its supply is the most tenuous and seasonal. And like, it means that supply and demand are really in tight regulatory balance.
Well, Tom, given what you're describing, just how disorderly is that financial system right now?
Oh, they're papering it over pretty good. And everybody's willful obtuseness and kind of ignoring it, not wanting to accept the fact that it's kind of fucked.
Well, when does it get their attention?
When somebody finally makes the move to upset the entire apple cart, and not slowly but dramatically.
And who might that be, and how and why would that be?
And to me, it would be the Russians doing what I said earlier about gold and oil.
Okay.
And the Chinese don't want to upset things too terribly. Uh-huh. I did a podcast with Alistair Crook the other day, and he, you know, said, look, they're not globalists in the same way that, you know, our European, quote, people who think that there are betters are. They're traitors. You know,
yeah, they're going to move the merch out of the factories.
Yeah, they're just the Chinese are traditionally and culturally traitors. T-R-A-D-E-R-S, not traitors, yeah. Right? Yeah. So when you think of it in those terms, they don't want to do that. The Saudis announced the other day that they're going to start taking yuan for their oil. The Russians have been selling their oil in a mix of euros, rupees, yuan, and rubles for a long time. I think one of these days, if the reports are that we've frozen as much of their foreign exchange reserves as is reported by a lot of people, mm-hmm. that it's more than half, then they will almost have no choice mm-hmm. but to offer their gold at a discount, or their oil at a discount for gold. They will almost be forced into that.
Well, Russia and China have both been accumulating gold, including a lot of their own production, for years and years. Mm-hmm. Well, what is the basic intention of loading your central bank with gold?
Well, again, it's outside money. So now you can support your own domestic inside money, your domestic financial system, mm-hmm. with an outside asset that they can't screw with externally. The other thing that the Russians are going to do, and they're already kind of doing it, moving stepwise through this process, is to eventually the Russians are going to close their capital account completely. They're already almost there, mm-hmm. right? When they do, they've already removed the value added tax on purchasing a physical gold. Mm-hmm. And they did that, and that created such a rush on physical gold within the Russian market, they had to then 2 weeks later, you know, stop that. Stop the sales of physical gold through the banks. But they also then said that the banks were going to be allowed to sell the physical gold directly at zero markup or hold it on their balance sheets at par as a reserve asset, which, by the way, the Turks already do, which is part of the reason why the Turkish economy has not collapsed, even though the lira has collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
So if the Russians are smart, and they are, they're going to create a domestic version of the ruble that does not trade overseas. Mm-hmm. And you'll have to go through the Russian central bank and the Russian capital account, the Russian central bank, in order to get access to the internal markets of Russia. And that internal domestic ruble will be backed with gold, convertible to gold directly. And once that is in place, do your worst, Joe Biden. There's no way you can fuck with this at this point. And oh, by the way, we still export, you know, 6 million barrels of oil a day. Y'all can pay for it in gold. And we'll sell it to you at a discount.
And where's Europe in the middle of all this?
Fucked.
Yeah, they do seem to be in a low-power situation.
Well, they are the sick old man at the table trying to lever their regulatory scheme into a global miasma of suck, basically. That was the whole point of the European Union, was to create a kind of Europe version of California. You know, California here in the U.S. is where every bad idea goes to thrive and then gets exported east, right?
You're right.
Right. Every time I bring that one up, I'm like, isn't that that's an old That's an old talking point from like the Reagan years or whatever. And every time I say it, everybody laughs like they've never heard it before. I'm like, really? Like I've been living with this since I'm like 12. I don't know. But yeah, like every bad idea starts in California and then travels east and is, you know, adopted by the rest of the country because California is the most powerful state within the union. And therefore, they can eventually force their way into, you know, forcing all the other states to go along with it. Well, the European Union is built along the same model because it's the same people who created California, created the European Union. Uh-huh. Right.
Tom, by the way, what is the reality of the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, and all that chit chat about a great reset? Is there any reality to
Absolutely.
It at all?
I think it's as real as it's I think it's even more real than people want to admit. That's, again, part of this willful obtuseness.
If their intentions are real, but really, what is their ability to pull anything like that off? Sounds insane to me.
It does sound insane, but the problem is that it actually is far less insane than you think it is because they have willful allies in the U.S. and British neoconservatives because their interests align on destroying China and Russia.
Uh-huh.
And that's the dominant foreign policy position of the Brits and the Americans going back to the, you know, Reconstruction.
But that looks like it ain't going to happen.
It looks like it could happen. Every day I go back and forth, Jim. I'm going to be honest with you. I almost feel bipolar sometimes. I probably am to a lesser degree, and I manage it really well, or I just fake it to make it. I'm not sure. But, you know, you ask me on Tuesday whether I think there's going to be nuclear war, and I'm like, nah. And then on Wednesday, I see something else. I'm like, oh, my God. And on Thursday, I'm like, nah. And then on today, I'm like, yeah, nuke war, 35%? Like, I don't know at this point. Like, Davos and company don't have any other options, which is to crash the world economy and blame it all on world war in order to the same playbook they pulled in World War II.
Uh-huh.
Right. Build up a bad guy and then knock him down. They're in the building the propaganda wave now to knock him down, which is what they're doing with Putin.
But the reality is if, for example, they do destroy the global economy and the petroleum fossil fuel delivery system that is at the heart of it, we're going to be living in the Middle Ages again.
It's hard to imagine
they want that outcome.
Well, they do. Well, then what they think is going to happen is that they're going to be able to just put us all on, you know, on script and let the robots take it over. I think they're going to lose. I think they're going to lose in such a way that they do unbelievable amounts of damage. Right. Uh-huh. And that we're going to spend 10 years cleaning up the mess and getting back to where we are today.
Well, if Klaus Schwab is such an obvious James Bond villain, why doesn't some James Bond in America or England
take him out?
Right. I mean,
I keep waiting for it. And I think it's even deeper than Schwab. I think Schwab is, you know, I think Schwab is important, but I also think that there are people behind him.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I don't know. I'm waiting for it. And I'm waiting for that moment where the way you listen to Putin talk and you listen to Putin's speech yesterday and the two speeches he made to announce the recognition of the Donbass and the special operation to denazify Ukraine to start the war. You listen to all those speeches taken in total. You're beginning to see a guy who understands that he's fighting a war for the soul of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And he's willing to take the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune and global opprobrium, or not global opprobrium, but Western opprobrium, to get it done.
Yeah, he seems coherent and reasonable and intelligent.
Yes.
Despite all the propaganda arrayed against him.
Yeah, it's really quite impressive that he's held it together for this long, given the number of insults that have been hurled his way. And not just that, but with the way we've responded to his invasion of Ukraine.
And he handles himself with tremendous decorum, unlike our side.
Yes, without a doubt. But you can see, and I've been watching Putin for 10 years, because I've known for a long, long time that he's the pivotal figure of the 21st century. He's going to decide which path we go down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I know what they're working for now, which is to take that decision away from him. I don't know that that's going to happen. This is where everything is still up in the air. Right? So you ask certain questions about what I think is going to happen, and I just don't know. Because, you know, war is hell and it's really hard to predict what's going to happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
Facts on the ground are hard to come by during a war. So, but I look at Putin and I say, our response to Russia's invasion in the financial markets has been shocking. And it's not just shocking to him in the how utterly horrific the sanctions package is towards actual Russian people, because it's aimed directly at the Russian people to, hey, if you don't stop supporting him, we're going to destroy you all. Right? That is the message from the sanctions package. And by the way, the Russian people understand this completely, and which is why they're not going to knuckle under, and which is why Putin's approval rating, I can believe Putin's approval rating has gone from around 60% to over 70%. I can believe that. Even bracketing for the fact that, you know, Russian polls may be, you know, yeah, they'd be lying, they'd be a bit propaganda, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I'm willing to, you know, bracket them plus 5% in either direction. I'm okay with that. But, you know, just kind of a priori, it makes sense that, you know, if he's made his case internally and they've looked at what the U.S. and company have done, you know, all these, you know, getting Arnold Schwarzenegger to come out there and say, oh, I love the Russian people. And blah, blah. Like, no, you don't. You fucking hate us. And we know you hate us. You've always hated us. And every time, and all that has to happen for that hatred to show up in any way is for us to tell you no about the smallest thing. Trump. Oh, we'll blame it on Putin. And then all of a sudden, you know, 50% of the population of the United States, you know, hates Putin. You know, it's dumb. Like, you know, you people just hate Russians because there's two generations of people who grew up with the imprinting that the Russians were the enemy and they can't let it go.
Yeah.
It's just that simple. Well, and it's all those people aren't in power anymore, you know, and they're all up to their eyeballs in debt and corruption and everything else.
Hey, everybody. We're proud of our association with David McIlvaney's ICA Wealth Management as a sponsor of this podcast. And I recommend you listen to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, David's fine podcast, out every Tuesday and available at iTunes Podcasts. Gold has been on a roller coaster, but we got a clue about where it's moving later this year. Think money printing from sea to shining sea. Can you spot an inflationary trend? When dollars lose purchasing power, it's time to think about wealth preservation. It's time to think about gold. There is no better asset for building a stable foundation for your portfolio, and Vaulted is the easiest way to invest in gold. Vaulted is an online mobile web app for investing in allocated and deliverable physical gold. Buy and secure gold with ease and convenience, giving you full control over securing your financial future. Vaulted delivers the best prices every time, along with personal advising from the experts at McIlvaney ICA. Join thousands of investors who have discovered these benefits for wealth preservation in an increasingly worrisome time. Visit Kunstler.com/vaulted to learn more about the Vaulted program at McIlvaney ICA and earn this podcast a referral point when you sign up. That's Kunstler.com/vaulted, V-A-U-L-T-E-D. And now back to the show. Speaking of American leadership, namely Joe Biden and company, you know, Jake Sullivan and Tony Blinken, et cetera. What do you make of American leadership, especially in contrast to what we're seeing in Russia?
Purposefully incompetent.
Vandals. Purposefully. Okay, unpack that a little bit.
Sure. This was a war that was chosen by the West.
Mm-hmm.
Putin didn't choose this war. He just chose the time.
Mm-hmm.
They chose the place. They chose the general, you know, season of when this was going to take place. And Putin said, okay, well, it's going to be on the 24th and not the 27th. Because on the 24th, I'm going to move these people across the border in such a way that you're not prepared. And I'm going to wipe out Ukraine as a functional army in 24 hours, which is what he did. I have argued this with multiple people that do think that the Russians have not actually met their objective of neutralizing the Ukrainian army's ability to do anything organized.
I get that all day long.
It's absolutely true. It's absolutely true that they have done this. Now, whether or not they're going to be able to micromanage the destruction of everybody else that's still on the ground operating, well, that's a harder task. And that's something you're going to do in a week. And anybody who thinks that, you know, well, you could do it in a week, but it would entail like killing 20 million Ukrainians. Mm. And the that's very clear that Putin doesn't want to kill 20 million Ukrainians, or he would have already done so. Because he just would have bombed them to the Stone Age the way we would have done it. Because I got news for you, Jim. You know this as well as I do, because we've all lived through it. When we invade a country, we turn it into a parking lot and then move our troops in. And then turn it, and then the next hectare gets turned into a parking lot, and then we move the troops in.
Yeah.
For mop-up operations. The guys who are, you know, who didn't get bombed, you know, we shoot them in the head and then we keep moving. That's what we do. We carpet bomb the place, destroy the infrastructure, turn it into a hellscape. Then we're willing to commit manpower. The Russians aren't doing it that way. They prosecute war completely differently. Maybe it's not better, but it's the way they do it.
Well, let's say Mr. Putin actually meets his objectives. And I would say, as I understand it, his objectives are as follows. Mm-hmm. To eliminate the most extreme, quote, Nazified battalions of Ukrainian soldiers that are mm-hmm. concentrated around Luhansk and Donetsk. Mm-hmm. And to eliminate them as a force mm-hmm. and to create two sovereign new districts of Luhansk and Donetsk mm-hmm. and to create that rump state of Western Ukraine mm-hmm. that will probably not have much access to the Black Sea
and will be
neutral and not a member of NATO and will not cause any trouble in the world. Do you think that those objectives can be met?
I think his objectives were actually slightly more ambitious than that.
Okay.
They were that on February 26th. Today, add the province of Kherson, mm-hmm. Nikolaev, eventually Odessa, Zaporizhzhia, if I'm saying that right. Kharkov is a different story. I keep refusing to be seduced back into using all Ukrainian names for everything. So it's still Kiev, you know, and it's still Lugansk, not Luhansk to okay. me. I'm sorry, because it was Lugansk and Kiev up until like 6 months ago. You know, it's like it used to be an AK-47. Now it's a Kalashnikov. Have you noticed this? right. No, that's serious. Like
it goes back and forth.
Yeah. So I think that if you look at a map, and I've published this before, if you look at a map of what was Novorossiya going back, pre-Soviet days,
mm-hmm.
right?
That's the region around the Black Sea.
Right. And that goes all the way from around Kharkov in the north, or even Sumy and Cherniv up near Chernobyl, all the way around the Dnieper River out to Odessa. That is the primarily Russian ethnic portions of Ukraine. That is Novorossiya. The rump is around Kiev and in the upper and in the steppes where all the wheat fields are. Mm-hmm. There's no industry out there. Mm-hmm. It's all agriculture. And then you have Lvov, which the Poles want back. Mm-hmm. And you have Transcarpathia, which the Hungarians want back.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that this winds up with Novorossiya, rump Ukraine, Putin paying off the Poles and their righteous anger for being Polish, give them Lvov back because they can't help themselves.
Is that an asset or a liability for Poland?
I'm not going to say one way or the other.
Okay.
Ask me about the Germans and I'll tell you that it's a liability. The older I get, the more racist I become towards Germans. It's just, I hate to say it. And I'm willing to own that. I don't care. I'm Italian. I can't help myself. So, and then the Hungarians should get Transcarpathia, or at least get that area of far western Ukraine could be, you know, divvied up between Romania, Hungary, and Slovakia.
So it's a much more thoroughgoing disassembly.
I think so. I think it needs to be at this point because Zelensky refuses to surrender, because mm-hmm. Davos doesn't want him to surrender, because they want a war, because they want to turn this into a wider conflict, because it is the only way for them to not get blamed for destroying the world economy.
Mm-hmm.
Because what they're trying to do is thread the needle where they destroy the world, atomize Russia, and turn Ukraine, their goal is to turn Ukraine into a quagmire that drains the Russians of all their capital, drains the Russian people of their desire to be led by Putin. And then eventually they're supposed to rise up and overthrow him. And then we have a repeat of the 90s where basically they put Bill Browder in charge and then they can destroy Russia, take all their stuff. So it's basically, when you analyze the way these people think, it winds up being a game of 14-year-old D&D. Ever play D&D with 14-year-olds, which is basically kill them and take their stuff? Like, it's just a series of encounters. There's no story. Just we go from here to this random monster encounter, we kill them and take their stuff. What stuff do they have?
Oh, dear.
It's basically World of Warcraft, you know, without reading any of the quest text. So, which is the way I played World of Warcraft for 6 years. So, because to me it was kill them and take their stuff. But, you know, that was my way of, like, you know, dealing with the world as a 14-year-old. It was not my way of dealing with the way I wanted to deal with geopolitics, which is, okay, we need to sit down and negotiate. But that's the way these people are operating. They think of Russia as a vast thing to plunder. And then you have the neoconservatives who are ideologically driven by their hatred of Russians and Chinese for a variety of reasons, which I don't want to get specifically into, because it just, like, sets off all kinds of crazy responses from the algorithms. That's who they are, and that's what they are, and they will not stop. You know, I call them Trotskyites. The neocons are just the intellectual heirs, and some literal heirs, of Leon Trotsky and his cabal that was ousted from the revolution in 1917. Mm-hmm. And they've regrouped, and they have dug in like ticks in the British and American foreign policy establishment. And which was all, an outgrowth of, British foreign policy as shaped by Halford Mackinder's, Heartland theory from the turn of the last century. So when you put all that together, you have this, like, confluence of psychosis that just, that winds up in this space, this headspace of this is our mortal existential enemy. We need to take them out. Well, and if you watch what we're doing at a, not just us, but the Brits and Europe and everybody else, what they're doing is they're trying to desperately cleave Russia from China, to isolate Russia, to wipe her out. And what I'm starting to see, and what I've been most gratified to see so far, is that everybody west of Ukraine, or east of Ukraine, sorry, that includes even Turkey and Ankara, are siding with the Russians mm-hmm. in this fight. And some of South America, including Brazil. But you look, South America, the Saudis, most of OPEC.
So the whole world's not psychotic.
Right. The whole world isn't psychotic, just the West.
But speaking of psychosis and mass formation, our country, the USA, has looked pretty psychotic for quite a while. Do you see anything in the currents of the current events that could possibly lead America to redeem itself in some way? Or are we just hopelessly crazy now?
I think parts of us are hopelessly crazy. Uh-huh. Unfortunately, that part is in charge.
Yeah.
Talk to me after the November midterms.
Yeah.
Okay. Because there's a real opportunity here at the November midterms. Everything is cyclic, right?
How pissed off do you think the general public, including the many Biden voters, are about what has happened in the last 14 months?
I think they're very angry, and I don't think they've made their peace with it yet.
Uh-huh.
I think they're still wearing their Ukrainian flags on their masks,
yeah,
kind of thing. And they're living in that horrible state of denial of just not wanting to admit that they were wrong about everything.
Uh-huh.
Now, it won't take a massive shift of people like that who were in the center and, went along with COVID and all of this stuff because, they were scared, and rightly so. I think that there's an opportunity here for about somewhere between 10 and 15% of the U.S. population to finally realize they lie to us about everything. Now they're lying to us about the war. Mm-hmm. See, this is part of the reason why I would like to see Putin step up the operational tempo in Ukraine,
mm-hmm.
even if it does, unfortunately, I hate to say this. This is purely strategic from mm-hmm. my perspective,
mm-hmm.
not from any kind of humanist perspective. And I'll lose libertarian street cred for saying this. And I know that's flat out. But part of me says, up the operational tempo, Vlad. Civilians are going to die. War is hell. It's bloody. And unfortunately, this is a fight you can't avoid. Otherwise, you would have avoided it, continued to avoid it. So let's stop pussyfooting around, because what you need to do now is prove to all of these people in the West who have been propagandized into thinking that you're losing and that there's a possibility here that we could bring you to justice for your wayward ways. And we need to put the kibosh on that, because in doing so, that will wake up probably 1 in 10, if not 1 in 8 people in the United States, to the idea that, oh my God, they lie to us about freaking everything.
Yeah.
They don't just lie to us about COVID or about this or about, and they've lied to us about everything. And all of a sudden, you now have another 5 to 8% of the population. And now all those people that have that awakening aren't going to make the next leap, which is to, all right, Now I'm angry about it. Now I want these people driven, you know, I want these people taken down and driven before their, you know, their enemies and, you know, and hear the lamentation of their women. Like, we're going to get to the Conan moment, right? Like, I think 5% of the population, that there's a real possibility of that. And that's the 5% that will decide the midterm elections. Mm-hmm. And that could be a massive biblical wipeout of the Democrats to the point where even though there aren't enough seats in play in the Senate to create a flat out impeachment majority, because you need 2/3. I think that if these Democrats lose 70 seats in the House and 5 seats in the Senate, including a couple that were supposed to be safe, I think the political winds will have shifted to the point where you're going to have 11 senators going, oh, yeah, I'll vote to get rid of Biden. I think you'll get 11 Democrats who will go, yeah, I'm getting rid of this guy.
Yeah.
And then you impeach Biden, you put Harris in jail. They're both traitors for starting and prosecuting a war. The Russians come out with all of the evidence that they have of our malfeasance in, you know, in Ukraine from every level, from Clinton and the dossier to the potential for these bio labs or any of this stuff, none of which, you know, it's all they, you know, they have it all. And you know that they're, that they've already shown it all to the Indians and the Saudis. And
what are they waiting for?
The ability to put it out in a formal setting where it can be heard and cannot be ignored.
Okay. So they don't want to get the Hunter Biden New York Post treatment.
This is why there cannot be a settled conflict in Ukraine. Yeah. Once it's a settled conflict, then we're into the post-war negotiations. During the post-war negotiations, as I said to – I was talking to Alexander Mercurius at the Duran the other day about this. And I said, Alex, you were a lawyer. What is the one thing that Wall Street never wants to do in any lawsuit against it or any of these people? Go to discovery.
Yes, right.
They never want to get to discovery. They always want to settle out of court before we go to discovery. Well – imagine the post-war scenario where the Russians now get to say, oh, by the way, you think we're war criminals for invading Ukraine like we did? Well, here's all of our evidence of the genocide and the mass graves of ethnic Russians at the hands of the Azov Battalion that you guys did nothing about and that we complained bitterly. And here's the 12 times we complained bitterly at the UN and the Security Council did nothing about it. Oh, by the way. And then there's this, and then there's this, and then there's this, and then there's that. As far as we're concerned, this is where Putin and his international law background and his lawyer background will kick in and go, and oh, by the way, as far as we're concerned, that makes us justified under Article 12 of the UN Charter for going in as a humanitarian mission. Sit on that and stew on it. And you know goddamn well that they do not want to see that happen in public because that would be the ultimate red pill.
Yeah.
The ultimate black pill. And that would destroy not just the United States as the leader of the free world, but it would destroy Davos as the think tank for the world. Uh-huh. Because all of a sudden, every weak European coalition government that they have their hooks into will collapse. Meanwhile, the main reason why the European Union was constituted and sold to the European people in the first place was to stop another war on the European continent. And yet these people are actually trying to foment one.
Yeah.
And that's the raison d'etre for the European Union, which tells me that the European Union is now on the verge of is easily collapsed under the right set of psychological circumstances, where the right information is put in front of them at the right moment, in the right way, where the lies are all exposed and everybody has this massive mimetic collapse. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh.
Tom, this has really been a fabulous chat. Very, very informative with a lot of ideas that I think people haven't encountered before. The kind that you were talking about earlier in the show that makes people slap their heads and say, why didn't I think of that? But we got to cut it off now.
Sure.
I look forward to talking to you more about this as things, you know, these fast moving events go forward.
I'll be happy to, Jim.
That would be great.
I love coming on. I always like talking to you. As a matter of fact, I need to invite. I'll send you an invite. Maybe I can have you on my podcast and we can continue the conversation there.
All right. Well, we'll do that again, too. It's been a pleasure. Keep your seatbelt on and don't get too caught up in the emotion of it all, as you know, we all tend to do. And we will ride again.
All right.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.